Hey.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. How's it going?
Oh, you know, it's going, I guess. How about yourself?
Great.
Yeah, it's been a while, I think, like 6 years or so.
Yeah, something like that. So tell me about this, what you're doing here with Deadly Blessing.
About a year ago, I started co-hosting a podcast with a friend of mine that he started called The Film Buds. We ran it jointly for a while, and then August of 2021, he left to join the Air Force. And so I decided to take over running the show. I try to keep every month sort of in a specific theme. And this month we're doing 2 weeks of sort of religious horror of a certain kind, or horror with religious elements for the Easter holiday. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at some movies, and I thought that because of the whole Hettite thing and that sort of thing, that Deadly Blessing would be a good one for the episode. And so my co-host, who's also my wife now, and I are going to review and talk about Deadly Blessing and Prince of Darkness as our main episode. And so that's kind of, we're going to review and sort of discuss it. And since I knew you and I knew Professor Barr, I decided that I would reach out to y'all and you know, get some input on the movie directly from the writers themselves. You graduated from UCLA in 75. You got your MFA there, is that correct?
Yes, MFA in playwriting.
Okay. And you, that was also where you met Matt Barr, your fellow co-writer. Just to sort of get into the swing of things, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself and about some of your background?
Sure. Well, you know, I was an English major in college. I always wanted to really not be a screenwriter. I wanted to be a playwright. So that's why I went to, I got my degree in playwriting at UCLA, my MFA. And I knew really nothing. I mean, I'd read all these great plays, but I was never involved in theater, really, actually putting on a play or acting in a play or directing a play. So I wanted to actually get hands-on experience. And it was a really good program. It was a two-year program. The only thing is, I realized at the end of it that I couldn't make a living as a playwright. You know, there's only a handful of people who actually, you know, make their livings that way. So I didn't want to be a professor and do it on the side or do it as a hobby. I wanted to make a living as a writer. So I thought, well, I'm in Los Angeles, so I should try screenwriting because you can actually make some pretty good money as a screenwriter. And that's what I did when I got out of the program. I met Matthew Barr. He was getting his bachelor's in film. So I thought, well, he would be good to write with because he knows more about film than I do. So that's what we did. We thought, okay, well, what should we write? And I thought, well, horror would be good. I always loved horror movies. But also, it's a good, for a beginning writer, you can get your first credit in horror a lot easier than you can in other things. You know, because in horror, you don't really need a famous writer. You don't need a famous cast. You just need a really good script and that's scary, you know, and they can do them on fairly low budgets. So we thought, okay, let's do horror. And I had read an article, and I think it was National Geo, about the Amish people. And that they live like in the Middle Ages, you know, they don't use electricity and it's a very medieval kind of worship and they're disconnected from the modern world and all that. And they have this, you know, they believe in spirits and demons and things like that. So I thought, well, this is interesting. This would be a good world to set a horror movie, you know? So that's where it started. You know, okay. let's do a horror movie set among the Amish.
No, I think that that's great. So I guess out of a little bit of curiosity, when you were planning on being a playwright primarily, were you interested in telling more sort of horror-centric plays?
I mean, I did write a play with a writing partner named Will Sims. We wrote a play called Demons, which was based on the last days in the life of Edgar Allan Poe. So, you know, my interests were always kind of with dark subjects. You know, I liked that. I liked the Gothic. I liked Edgar Allan Poe. I liked, you know, those kinds of subjects. So I think it kind of made sense to do horror. You know, plus the fact, you know, when I was growing up, those movie, you know, books like by Stephen King and Carrie and Poltergeist and those kind of movies. I mean, I really related to those kind of movies. So I just thought, well, you know, I'm interested in that kind of material. And it made sense, you know, in terms of the kinds of stuff that I like, but it also made sense, like I said, in terms of what would be a good script to begin with. You know, what's most commercial? And people always love horror, you know, so, and you don't need a big budget. So, and you know, the possibilities of for a producer or production company of making a really good profit is very high with horror, because you've already got an audience that all, you know, that goes to horror movies. It doesn't matter what it is, they just want to go to horror movies. And you've got the possibility of sequels. So for both aesthetic and for commercial reasons, it made sense to me. You know, I mean, I was just sort of shooting in the dark. I didn't know much about the film industry, but I sort of figured that part out, you know?
No, absolutely. So you guys decided to go and sit down and write this screenplay. How long did it take y'all to sort of write the first few drafts of it before it ended up also getting picked up?
Oh, it didn't take that long to write a couple drafts, because at that time I'm young and I was very enthusiastic, and you know, I would just write. You know, I was just pumping stuff out, you know. So I'd say it probably took about 6 months to write a couple drafts, but that was just the beginning, because the way that we got it to the producer, Max Keller, was the head of this company called Intergalactic Productions. And he was just a beginning producer. He had done a couple of things, nothing big, but he was a lawyer and he had a production company, and I met his secretary at a party. And I was talking to her, and she asked me what I did. I said, I'm, you know, beginning screenwriter. And she said, oh, you know, my boss might be interested. And I said, well, it's a horror movie. And she goes, oh yeah, I think he'd really like that. So he read the script and he really loved the concept, you know, of it. The whole thing with the Hittites, the Amish, and the horror and all that. So, and he also realized, you know, it could be done on a very realistic budget. You didn't need $10 million to do it. I mean, that at that time, $10 million was a lot of money. So we could do it with a minimal budget. And so I got hooked up with him, and he wasn't great with giving notes, but he tried to bring in different directors and people to give notes on how to make it better. And at the same time, he had bought this book by Lois Duncan called Summer of Fear. And he needed a writer to you know, translate that into a screenplay to sell it as a TV movie. So he hired me to write the screenplay of that based on Deadly Blessing and the script. And the network amazingly accepted me as the writer because I was an unknown, you know, but they agreed to that. And he got Wes Craven to direct it. So that's how we met Wes Craven. And the TV movie did really well. And at that time, Wes Craven was kind of an unknown too. He had never, you know, this was before Scream. This is before A Nightmare on Elm Street, all those big horror movies that came later. He had just directed a little independent horror movie called Last House on the Left, which was a hit in the independent circuit. But anyway, he directed, ended up being called A Stranger in Our House. And it did really well in the ratings. So we got him to agree to direct Deadly Blessing. And he knew horror way better than any of us did. So he gave us notes, and then he actually did a pass of his own on the script. So that's how we got the script to be a lot better. We did rewrites. And it was also getting a director attached, which was, you know, once you have a director and you have a good script, you're pretty close to getting it produced if, you know, company likes it, because getting a director is one of the biggest, you know, the hardest things to do. So we had that, and he was, you know, getting a reputation as a great horror director. And so there was a company that was just being formed. They had gotten a bunch of money. They had never produced anything, but they wanted to produce quickly 5 movies. And one of the movies they wanted to do was a horror movie. So we submitted it to them. They greenlit the movie. You know, they liked the script. They really liked Wes Craven. And that's how it got made, you know, which was that. That was after, you know, I'd say at least 3 years after we first attached Max Keller as the producer. It took us about 3 years to do the rewrites, to get Wes on board, to find the right production company that was willing to do it. And it just all came together. You know, a lot of getting movies made is a lot of luck, you know, mm-hmm. and the stars have to be in alignment. You know, everything kind of comes together. And in this particular instance, everything came together. And we had a budget of $3 million, which at that time was, you know, pretty low budget. The great thing too about Deadly Blessing was it was all set in this one little town, you know, this one little Amish town where these people were. So it's not like it was easy to produce. You didn't have to go here, go there. You had this one little area. You had a farm. You had a barn. You had, you know, you had very minimal locations. So that was also in our favor, that you could, you know, make it for $3 million. And we had a pretty decent crew. We had a really good crew, but we also had, you know, a great cast. We had Sharon Stone. It was like her second movie. I think she had done a Woody Allen movie, you know, just as a bit player. Nobody knew who Sharon Stone was, but, you know, she's very pretty, and she didn't really know. She was a model, I think, but everyone thought, oh, she's very photogenic, and, you know, and she didn't play the star role. But she was one of the girlfriends. And, you know, after that, she became a huge star. So, you know, we had a pretty decent cast.
No, yeah. I mean, Sharon Stone, Ernest Borgnine. It was definitely a great little cast.
Oh, there was Lois Nettleton, mm-hmm. who was pretty well-known stage actress, and she had done a lot of, you know, character stuff. So yeah, we had a lot of, you know, a lot of good actors. And that's all you really need in horror. I mean, you don't need a big star. Some of the best horror movies I can think of didn't have big stars, you know?
No, absolutely.
So you just need a really good premise, good actors, and a really, you know, something you hadn't seen before. And nobody had seen this kind of Amish horror movie thing, you know? The only other Amish movie I can think of at that time was Witness, but that wasn't horror. It was about the Amish people. And I think people were very intrigued by the idea that there's this kind of cultish group living, you know, in a modern world, but they're not modern at all. They live according to these principles, you know, from hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
So people were intrigued by that.
No, I mean, it's, you know, looking back at, I've really gotten more and more into horror over the years. And, you know, looking at when Deadly Blessing comes out, 81, you know, you're kind of right there around the time of the slasher really taking off in the horror genre. And so, you know, Texas Chainsaw came out 74, Halloween came out 78. I think Halloween 2 is 81 as well. And I think that Deadly Blessing kind of taps into that nice storytelling that the slasher provides, which is get people to a location, you know, and then just sort of build up the tension and build up that atmosphere sort of around them. And so I think that it fits nicely into sort of what was happening, especially with the horror genre at that time. And so I definitely understand why it was appealing then, and I understand why it's still appealing now, because it also has, you know, the isolation aspect of it, as you were talking about, which works both in terms of the production value, but also in terms of the storytelling to build some of that sense of dread as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of beginning writers don't understand how important this is, that you can make a movie, that you write a movie that can be done on a modest budget. And that becomes so appealing to producers, you know, whether it's comedy, whether it's horror, whether it's even, you know, a drama, that you don't need a big budget. You don't need a big star. And beginning screenwriters don't seem to take that into account, you know, that the less locations, the better. Because, you know, the hardest part in a movie is lighting. You know, every time you move from one room to the next, you have to relight it. So the less you have to move a crew around and light everything, the less time it's going to take. So the less locations, the less actors, the better. We don't want to move around a million times. You know, people think it's a movie, so it has to be so visual, so we have to have 100 locations, you know, but that's not true. No, we want as few locations as possible, as few actors as possible. I mean, here's a great example is A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
It was one of the, you know, the best horror movies, I'd say, in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years. That had like basically one or two locations, you know, and a very limited cast. And the star was also the director from The Office. But he's not a big, huge movie star, you know? I mean, people know him, people like him, but, you know, he's not Tom Cruise, you know? So that to me was the perfect horror movie.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, because it fits all of those horror things that you want. And it had the one great concept that no other horror movie I've ever seen does, which is that the monster couldn't see, but they had an incredible sense of hearing. And I'd never seen that before, you know? So that was a great concept, you know? It was a scary monster as can be. but it could only, its hearing was important, not its sight, not anything else. So that made it unique. And, you know, it was just very cheap to make. And look how much money that movie is made, you know?
Yeah.
So from a producer, you got to think from the producer's point of view. What does a producer want? They don't want huge budgets because then they have to get big stars, and it's hard to get a big star. So you want to, you know, think, you know, from a commercial point of view.
Yeah, no, I think that that's honestly a really good piece of advice. You know, it can be so easy to sort of get a little bit caught up, you know, a little bit runaway with what the concept is. But you look at some of the first films of a lot of different first-time screenwriters or directors or what have you, and they're all pretty minimal productions. You know, Clerks is all inside of the convenience store. Halloween, you know, it's a few places in LA. It's the school, you know, those few street corners and two houses. I had a third example.
Friday the 13th was.
Yeah.
Was another one.
Put them all out at the campgrounds, you know?
Yeah.
So
you get a deserted, you know, summer camp. And that's it. That's all we need, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And yeah, it also, I think, definitely helps focus in on your storytelling abilities also, you know, because now multiple characters have to track in some way emotionally through that whole period. You know, you don't just have this barrage of this revolving door of characters, you know, you have to stick with certain characters throughout the story. So I think it's also a good point just in terms of really learning character and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
The Coens, that's what I was going to say. Blood Simple.
Blood Simple. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, very simple. Very simple. But you need a good story. You need a good villain, because in horror, the villain a lot of times is the star, you know, like in Alien, you know, it was the villain that was just like, oh, wow. I mean, it was incredible. I've never seen a villain like that before. Scary as can be. So, yeah, or like A Quiet Place, you know, that was a very unique villain. And, you know, a protagonist who you can root for.
Yeah.
One thing that I've noticed in horror, because I do webinars and, you know, I do a lot of consulting. A lot of beginning writers, I help guide them through their scripts. And one thing I noticed about horror, which is different than any other genre, and that is that in a drama and comedy and suspense and action, all these things, characters need some kind of a character arc. You know, they need to start one place and end somewhere else. And that's what makes a great protagonist. They're not the same at the end as they were in the beginning, right? Lethal Weapon is a great example of that. Mel Gibson. He wants to kill himself at the beginning of the movie. By the end, he's joining the family and society. He doesn't want to kill himself anymore. That's his character arc. And that's a great character arc. And great movies, you know, have great character arcs. But in horror, you don't necessarily need that. I mean, sometimes you'll have a character arc in a movie, like Scream has, the main character has a character arc. But I can cite you many horror movies where you just have a very likable protagonist who is in danger of being killed, and their whole journey is to protect themselves and protect their loved ones. And that's it. They don't change. They're not different at the end than they were in the beginning. You know, they always had guts. They always had, you know, survival instinct. They were strong characters. They weren't weak characters. But they didn't change it from emotionally. you know, from going from one extreme to the other, like you see in, you know, like I said, like in Lethal Weapon or one of those movies. So audiences love character arcs, but in horror, it's not really necessary. And so, you know, that's just a unique aspect of horror.
No, for sure. Taking some of what we've talked about directly to Deadly Blessing, I think that I think that the movie does a really good job of doing a little bit of a fake out, you know, for so long. You know, that movie really does point you toward the idea that whatever is terrorizing her is very directly tied to Ernest Borgnine and the Hittite followers and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in so many movies, the sort of bald, you know, mentally impaired, you know, figure would probably have ended up being like the reveal that it was them as the killer, you know, this person from the society that was a little bit of an outcast. And then, you know, your movie does this sort of reversal on that, where he's one of the first major casualties of the movie. And I think that it does a really good job at subverting your expectations, but also regularly still leading you in one direction until suddenly the reveal comes at the end of who the real killers are. But it still works so well because then you go back and you watch it through a second time, and like any good mystery, you know, all of the hints and all of the clues are kind of lined up throughout the story.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. So yeah, it's great to have, you know, a mystery. Who's doing this? You know, I think that reminds me of Scream, where in Scream, that actually was a student of mine, Kevin Williamson, was in a writing group that I was that I had. I had really good writers in this writer's group. As well as being a professional screenwriter, I always, you know, would teach workshops and I would have writing groups. And I had an amazing writing group that Melissa Rosenberg was in. She ended up becoming a huge screenwriter of the Twilight movies, and she was one of the producers and executive producers on Dexter, and I mean, she became huge. And the other one was Kevin Williamson, who wrote Scream and all those kind of movies. He was in that group. So anyway, we worked on Scream, and I thought one of the things about Scream that was so interesting, that instead of having one killer, you had two, you know? It was these two guys who were doing this. And I thought, that's different. That's a bit of a twist. So, you know, it's really great to have some kind of a twist. You know, I keep asking people that are writing horror, you know, what's different about this than any other horror movie? And you need something different, just like in A Quiet Place, like in Scream, A Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, this guy exists in your dreams and your nightmares, you know. I mean, you need that. Because, like I say, we've seen so many horror movies. And the horror, you know, audience is just huge, probably bigger than ever today. And they'll go to see anything. But they want something different. They don't want to see the same old slasher movie, you know. They want to see something that they haven't seen before. So, you know, you're always looking for that. And like I said, we found out with Deadly Blessing just because of the group, you know, the Amish Hittite people, which had, you know, people knew very little. Today, we know a lot about them. But at that point, no, people didn't know. That's when I read the National Geo article about them, and I went, wow, can you imagine these people live like this? And they're, you know, and they actually do quite well. They're really good farmers. They, you know, but they will not accept anybody that questions them in the group. They'll throw them out, just like Mormons will or any cult does. You know, when you question them, they shut down and they'll throw you out. So that raises the stakes of being in that group and doing something that's not absolutely in the tradition of the Amish. And if you've lived there your whole life, that can be a death sentence. I mean, that's all you know. So to be thrown out into the modern world, I mean, would be scary as can be, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the horror genre is also so much about, you know, transgressive topics that taking this ultra sort of repressive group and putting them into a horror genre, a horror film, does open up a lot of opportunities to play with how that sort of rigid structure and how that sort of mindset, and also how familially, you know, sort of connected it is, can end up becoming something that's horrific, you know? And so I think that works really well in the film.
Yeah, that's another part of horror. Like I said, at one point I did a webinar on horror, and I reread and, you know, saw a bunch of horror movies just to say, okay, what is it specific about horror, right? And one of the things, not only do you not need a protagonist that has a character arc, but another thing about it, which is unique, is that the more you repress something, the more violently it comes out when it does, right? When you can't hold it down anymore. So when you have a very repressive group or family, you know, who keeps pushing it down, not allowing it to be said or to be explored or anything like that, when it does emerge, it comes out in really horrific, violent ways. So that worked perfectly for the Hittites because they're so repressive. You know, sex and all that. I mean, they can't deal with any of that, you know?
Yeah.
And they can't deal with the modern world. So when it does, you know, and, or, you know, the girl who ends up becoming the real killer and her mother, I mean, she's being repressed because she's actually not a girl. So she's being repressed in such a incredibly, you know, violent way, such a repressive way, that when it does emerge, it comes out in, you know, these horrific ways. So repressing something violently, and you know, that's a good theme for horror.
No, absolutely. And you know, you were talking about a likable protagonist, a likable character, and whether or not that they need to have an arc. I think that the lead of Deadly Blessing, Martha, definitely has, she's got likability. And I think that that's also established just by putting her in, like, you know, a state of tragedy early on. You know, the audience wants to sympathize with her, I think, and empathize with her because her husband passes away. And so you sort of real quickly build this empathy and sympathy for her very quickly in the movie.
But yeah, they're both pretty, I mean, that was the key, is making them both sympathetic, mm-hmm. You know? And I think part of it was just Lois Nettleton is a very sympathetic actress, you know? So that helped a lot. So the real villains are very sympathetic. The who you think are the villains are not sympathetic. And, you know, and that, you know, fools the audience.
No, absolutely. So I don't want to take up too terribly much of your time, so I'll move a little bit off of Deadly Blessing. So you've written multiple things. You've written multiple television movies. You have a novel out, is that correct?
Yeah, I have a novel. Get it on Amazon. It's called Ink. I just wanted to write a novel. I always thought, what would it be like to write a novel? You know, so that was my, that was when I was getting toward the end of my career as a screenwriter. I thought, well, let me, you know, try this. And it took a lot longer than I ever thought. I got a lot more, you know, because you just think, you have to think very differently as a novelist than you do as a screenwriter. It's a completely different thing. So it took me a good while. It took years to, you know, finish that book. So yeah, I did that. And then I got to the point where, you know, I had been a screenwriter for probably 35 years or something. I mean, it was a long road. And I just couldn't do it anymore, you know? So I went, okay, well, I want to help other people write their screenplays. And like I said, I've been a teacher the entire time I was a screenwriter. I had workshops. I taught at UCLA Extension. I taught at the American Film Institute. I always loved teaching. So, you know, I got writing workshops, giving lectures, and now I do private consultations with writers. That really started during the pandemic because nobody wanted to meet in a group because they were afraid of, you know, getting COVID. So I did private consultations, and that's what I do now. I work with writers on a one-to-one basis, and I guide them through the process of writing a screenplay and as many rewrites as it takes. And then I help them with their marketing of the screenplay. So I love doing that because it keeps me creative and I get to work on other people's material. And, you know, it's a lot of fun for me. So that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. Over your, you know, you were writing for 35 years. You worked with all sorts of people. Just in a general sense, if you don't mind, if it's too broad a question, that's fine. How would you say that the industry has sort of changed, you know, from when you entered it to when you decided to exit?
Well, you know, I did a lot of TV movies, and that went out of style, right? So they didn't do TV movies anymore. But then now we've got streaming, which is basically the same as TV movies, except they're on Netflix or they're on Hulu or they're on Disney Plus or whatever. So I think this is a very exciting time. There's so much work for writers. They need content, you know? They desperately need content. So this is a time when, you know, when the TV movie went out of style, a lot of my contacts were in TV movies, and all those producers and production companies, they all went out of business. So that made it a lot harder. It's probably one of the things that, you know, convinced me I should, you know, get out of this business now, because it's, you know, I don't have, there's not the same amount of work that they needed before. I mean, they always needed TV movies. You could write it. It would get produced quickly. You know, it was a great thing. But now they, you know, it's streaming. So for beginning writers, I think this is a great time because, you know, there's so much, there's all these companies, they all need product. And it's the same as, you know, what was going on before with TV movies and series. And so, you know, it's a good time. It's a good time for writers.
No, I think that that's honestly incredibly fair. And going back to some of what we talked about earlier, you know, the quick turnaround on horror, you know, and the do it low, you know, reap what you can off of the returns. Horror is definitely, I think, an especially viable genre today. And I think that that's also one of the reasons that it is still so prolific, as well as just because like you said earlier, it is very easy to come up with a sweet 90-minute horror script, you know, that can be done very cheap and turned around and put on, you know, some of these streaming services or that sort of thing. So I think that that's a really fair point. What are you thinking about doing next? Now that you've gone and sort of left screenwriting, are you thinking about maybe doing another novel? Or are you just consulting now?
No, I'm just consulting.
Okay.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, it's really fun for me because, you know, the hard work is writing. It's really hard to write, okay? It's really hard to, you know, face those blank pages and go through all the rewrites. And, you know, like with Deadly Blessing, I mean, I heard so many rejections, you know, but all you need is that one person who says, wow, I really like this. You know, that's all you need is that one person who becomes the fan and who has some legitimacy in the business. And they say, hey, I think this is good. You know, you just need that one person, but you have to deal with a lot of rejection. And if you're an actor, if you're a writer, you've got to be able to deal with that, you know? So as a consultant, though, you're just there purely for the creativity. You're putting into practice everything you learned in a long career of how you write a screenplay and what every good screenplay needs. And as a writer, you can get so caught up in your plot and your characters, and you don't see the big picture. And so you just need that one person that says, hey, we need a very rootable protagonist. You know, and they go, oh, well, is my protagonist not that sympathetic? And I go, no, they're not. So let's make them more sympathetic so we can root for that person. You know, even if it's a anti-hero, you know, like a Tony Soprano, who was a murderer, basically. But the writers were clever enough to make Tony Soprano very sympathetic. And those are, you know, things that you learn as a screenwriter. You know, and so, you know, as a consultant, I can come along and look at something and understand pretty quickly what it needs, what it doesn't need, what works, what doesn't work. And then on top of that, because I'm a writer, you know, too, I can brainstorm with the person I'm working with and say, okay, let's think about how we can make this more interesting. And then we brainstorm and we come up with ideas, and sometimes they like my ideas, sometimes they don't, but that's okay. It's just opening yourself up to different options. And as a writer, you can get stuck, you know, kind of hitting your head against the wall thinking, I have to do it like this, I have to do it like that. And all you need is one person to say, hey, that's not working. Let's go a different way. Let's go in a different, you know, route. And all of a sudden, because I'm giving them the option to do that, they go, oh, you're right, let's do that. But if they were on their own, they would still try to go down that path that's not working. So they just need the permission. That's really what it is. They need the permission to say, no, that's not working. Let's try something else. Mm-hmm. And that's when you come up with good ideas.
No, for sure. Working both with you and with Matt Barr at UNCG when I was a student of his, you know, it was always good to hear outside voices, to kind of change up your perspective. And also to sometimes, like, you know, encourage you to take that one step, you know, further in the story that you maybe were hesitant on, you know, including yourself. And it also kind of reminds me of a sort of lesson that my wife told me about that she had when she was an actor, which is, you know, don't worry about what the script says. Why is your character coming into the room this way?
Yeah,
you know, get into the headspace, you know.
Yeah.
The script says they come in through the door, but why didn't your character come in through the window?
Right.
You know, kind of a thing. So no, I think that that's a really interesting point. Do you have any, I guess you've already given honestly a lot of free advice and wisdom. Do you have any sort of last pieces of advice or last thoughts that you
have? Last thing I have to say about all this is you're only as good as the feedback you're getting. Okay. So when I was a beginning writer, I'd ask my girlfriend to give me read my script, you know, or just a friend who knew nothing about film or nothing about what makes a great screenplay. And they would, and I would get feedback that was a lot of times just terrible. And I would do a draft and it would made the script even worse. So you really need to work with somebody. And, you know, I was lucky to meet Wes Craven. And he gave me great feedback because he knew what he was doing. He was in the business and he had done horror and he knew what made a great horror movie. So everybody needs a Wes Craven. You need somebody who knows screenplays, who knows how to critique them, who knows exactly how to get to the core of what's not working, and then help you to brainstorm and coming up with better solutions. And you don't, you know, you don't, if you're, if you don't go to another beginning screenwriter to get notes on your screenplay. That's ridiculous. If you were trying to be a great pianist, Would you work with a great mentor, teacher who had already, you know, done concerts and knew everything about playing the piano? Or would you go to another beginning pianist? No, you'd go to somebody who knows what they're doing and can give you great advice, great feedback. You're only as good as the feedback you're getting. And everybody needs great feedback. Nobody gets it right on the first go-round. Nobody. I don't care how talented they are. You know, you need great feedback. So go to professionals who know how to professionally critique what you're doing and help you to write a better script. Don't give it, you know, I have a group on Facebook. It's called the Secrets of Screenwriting Group. And I always get these posts from beginning screenwriters saying, who can read my script and give me notes? And I'm going like, why would you do that? Why would you ask another beginning screenwriter to give you notes on your screenplay? That's asking for trouble. Go to somebody who's trained to do that. And it takes a lot of knowledge. It takes a lot of work to get to the point where you can, you know, really zero in on exactly what the problems are and then help the person to, you know, fix those problems. That doesn't come from just graduating from NYU film school. You know, that comes from a lot of work. So I'm just, you know, amazed that beginning writers want other beginning writers to help them with their scripts. I mean, that's absurd. No athlete goes to athletes go to professional coaches who have worked with in that sport for many years. And they know exactly how to make, like in tennis, they know exactly how to help, you know, somebody like Rafa become a great tennis player. They don't go to other beginning tennis players to become their coach. You know, so you just have to be very careful who you're asking advice and notes from, because you need great feedback.
No, I think that's another really well said point. You know, it is one thing to have learned, you know, in school certain skills. It's another thing to have practical experience about, you know, the transitionary period of the first draft to the moment that it's filmed, you know, and edited, to help you look at what's going on in the mechanics of the script itself. So I think that that's a really, really fair point. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was nice going back to those golden days of Deadly Blessing.